Just testing. One moment. I can test the audio on the stream. Testing. Check. Thomas, since you're online, can you verify whether you can hear us or not? I think it's coming through the speaker anyways. Okay. I have some confidence that it should work fine. I don't know why it's playing back through the speaker here. I can't exactly hear it over my computer. Just a second. Okay. Well, we're gonna get started. If Thomas or anybody else online can tell me whether or not the sound is coming through, just let me know. It sounds like it might be, but I don't know why it's going. Ah, I know why. It's because I have the HDMI plugged in and my sound is being fed through the speaker there. Okay. So, then, yes. Welcome to the second tutorial for the data science course for security and forensics. Did anybody have a look at the exercises before coming in to the tutorial today? So, anybody looked at the material more or less? If not, then we'll just cover it together. Yeah. All right. So the focus for today is mostly on model evaluation, in particular, evaluating supervised learning models. So, just to start out, what are some evaluation measures for regression? Do we remember what those are? How do we remember, or how do we measure whether or not our regression model is a good fit, say, on some testing data that we have?
Mean squared error, I think.
Mean squared error, right. So this is like the major one. And then there's some other ones too, if anybody recalls. All right, so here are really the common ones. Like you said, the mean squared error. And I'm going to show you visually what this is in the next slide, but at the moment, we're just taking a look at some equations. So basically, it's the average squared difference between the predicted, so that being here, and the observed value. So this is, as you see, the error, and you square it, you sum it up, take the average. There's also the mean absolute error, which is essentially the same thing, but rather than squaring the difference between the expected value and the predicted value, we're just taking the absolute value rather than squaring it. And then there's the root mean squared error, which is essentially just the mean squared error, but then we take the square root at the end. So in terms of like motivating kind of why we're taking these measurements, here's a visualization of what's more or less going on. So for like mean squared error, we're literally taking the average of the area of squares of the error that we're obtaining from our application of the model into the data. So, I mean, for instance, here we have these data points here, and our model right now is just we're predicting y equals x, and you can see here we say have this distance between our prediction and the error. We square it, that gets us the squares, which we sum and take the average of, yeah? And we take the average such that otherwise then, I mean, just it would depend, your error would depend on the number of samples on the actual model. So the intuition clearly is that smaller this mean, smaller the squares, better the fit, right? And we can calculate this with respect to the training data or testing data. In particular, most of the time, if you're evaluating the model, you'd be calculating the mean squared error with respect to the testing data. Typically speaking, the mean squared error, mean absolute error, when you're evaluating on the testing data, is going to be higher than on the training data, right? Why might we want to use the mean absolute error or the root mean squared error over something like the mean squared error? Like, why do we square the error in mean squared error? There's two reasons. Yes. Yes, so the first item is that it will make the error positive. So that way you're not having the errors actually like cancel each other out, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's another reason, and that is more or less that the square punishes large errors and more or less rewards small errors. So if you have an error that's less than 1, you square this decimal value, it's going to get even smaller, right? And if the error is above 1, then the error is quite a lot larger. But then why would we want to use something like the mean absolute error or the root mean squared error? It's kind of a more interpretable measure of the error because it's actually on the scale of what we're measuring. So on the mean absolute error, I mean, we're saying, okay, here we are having an error of 1. Here we're having an error of maybe also 1. And you add this up and you take the mean of it. And it's a kind of more interpretable. If you, for instance, are taking these areas of these squares, yes, you get an idea of the error, but it's not exactly super interpretable with respect to your actual data, right? It's kind of a different scale. And likewise, the root mean squared error is kind of just a more interpretable version of the mean squared error. So obviously you're squaring these errors for the mean squared error. You take the square roots, then you're kind of getting back to the original scale that you had. So it's kind of similar to the idea of how standard deviation is the square root of variance, which makes it more interpretable. Yeah? So those are some basic measures for regression. Any questions with regards to these measures or how they're calculated? It's not super crazy. let's move on to the next one. So why do we care about performance evaluation in general? So why do we care about, say, measuring like the accuracy of these models? Like, what's the point? Well, I'll tell you. Basically, one of the major points is, how well does your trained model perform, in particular on unseen test data? So, for instance, we're trying to assess how well a model performs generally. Yeah, this is, I'd say, probably the largest reason why we care about performance evaluation on these supervised tasks. But there's also other reasons why you might want to use performance evaluation measures. So, for instance, the metrics can be used to compare different models on trained and tested on the same dataset source. So basically, given some dataset, this model A is more accurate than this model B, saying, like, this model we're showing kind of empirically, at least with respect to this dataset, that this is the superior model. This deep neural network has 98% accuracy over this naive Bayes approach, which only has 90% accuracy. We're saying, at least in this case, this model kind of works superior. Another reason why we use it is these metrics can be used to compare the performance of models trained and tested on completely different data sets. And this is a bit more, say, atypical, but it's still useful. So, for instance, model A performs well when trained and tested on data set X. So we're having some data set X where we split it into a training data set and a testing data set that we're testing it on. But then the model performs, say, poorly when trained on data set X but tested on, say, some other data set Y. So as an example, there's some research I was looking at recently where there was these speech recognition systems that were trained on one particular data set. That was the common benchmark data set for speech. And it's, say, very clean speech. It's very, you can, if you listen to it, it sounds like it's coming from the news, something like this. Now, if you take a model trained on this data set, but now you are applying and evaluating this model on, say, a data set where they're discussing maybe something like different topics, or maybe the speech is more irregular, then you can also see, you'll see, oh, this model performed not nearly as well as it performed on the testing data set from the clean data set, right? So this is another use of performance evaluation. Any questions so far? Okay, so before we get into it, what are some good measures for say, supervised learning, in particular classification, when we have binary classification? We have just, we're saying, given some sample, we're classifying it into class A or class B. What are some good evaluation measures that we might use? Yes?
Classification accuracy?
Classification accuracy. So this is a big one. So what about in the case where maybe we have an imbalanced data set, imbalanced testing data set? What performance measures might be more useful there?
Precision.
Right, so precision. And then there's another one.
That
recall. Precision and recall. So these are quite common in the case where you have imbalanced data sets. And we're going to go into that and kind of talk about why that is. Right, so there's the classification accuracy, which is more or less just a percentage of the properly classified samples, and this not only works for binary classification, it works for multinomial classification. Yes?
There was just a message from someone online that they can't see or hear anything.
They cannot see or hear anything. That's not good. Let me ask... are they on the For Lessening stream?
I think he's on Zoom.
Right. Let me just check here. Yeah, I know it's. I know the microphone is muted for Zoom, but if you could test if you could hear us or see us using the For Lesning stream, which is what we're using for the actual streaming and recording today. If you could verify that. In the meantime, okay, great, thanks. So you can hear on the stream, okay, good. Yeah, so I'll be using, just to not kind of make a duplicate of the streaming and recording, I'm using For Lesning for the actual streaming and recording, visual audio, and Zoom for me is just going to be the chat, unless we had something like last week. But I arranged it so that now we're in rooms that always can be streamed using the For Lesning system. Thank you. Okay. But then there's also the confusion matrix, which is a, it's not necessarily like a measure or a metric, but it's a good representation of showing the performance of your classification models. So have you guys seen this matrix before, right? So on kind of one axis you have saying, okay, these are the what the machine learning model predicted versus the actual, say, target values of our data. And so if a positive sample is predicted as positive, then that adds one to this true positive box, and so on and so forth for all of the other boxes, false positive, false negative, true negative. And we'll see another example of that a little later. Yeah? On to this topic of useful measures for binary classification, especially for imbalanced test data. Those being precision and recall. So kind of the technical example or technical description of precision is the percentage of samples identified as positive that are actually positive. And we have a visualization here as well. I like to describe this in terms of like document retrieval. So say you have a case where you have, I don't know, you have some disk image where you're looking for relevant documents on this particular image. And say whatever classifier you had identified, say, 100 relevant documents. Yeah? But it turns out that only 70 of these documents are actually relevant. So that would yield you 70% precision, right? So of the things you identified as relevant, only 70% of them are right. That is the measure of precision. Then there's recall, which is the percentage of positive samples that were identified as positive. This is the true positives over the total amount of positives. And this is more or less saying, okay, in the example of, say, document retrieval for some image. So, again, say that in total there is actually 200 relevant documents known to be on this image, but you have only identified, let's say 140, to make the math a little easier, 140 relevant documents on the image, and you have identified 70 relevant documents. So you have a total recall of 50%. You found only 50% of what was relevant on the image. Yeah? So this is kind of another example illustrating the usefulness of precision and recall, say, compared to accuracy in imbalanced test data in particular. So assume you have 20 software samples, 3 of which are malicious, 17 of which are benign, and you have a classifier that predicts whether a software is malicious or, malicious being the positive class, or benign, the negative class. Does 85% accuracy mean that we have a good classifier? No, right? So you might have the following confusion matrix. So looking here, we only have one true positive, and we have 16 true negatives. So that's 17 over 20. This is 85% accuracy. Sounds good, kind of at first blush, but it's not really, right? So of the samples that you predicted as malicious, say there's one true positive here and one false positive, only 50% was actually malicious, right? So this is 1 over 2. And then of the all of the malicious samples, you only identified one of the malicious samples out of all possible three malicious samples. You had two misses. You had two false negatives, right? So 50% precision, 33% recall. Maybe they're not the best performance if you're wanting to identify malicious software samples, right? Just some more details regarding precision and recall. Precious. This is a misspelling, clearly. More precious recall details. Precision and recall details. So precision and recall, they typically have an inverse relationship. So it's difficult to maximize one and also maximize the other. So maximizing recall tends to reduce precision. Say, imagine you're kind of widening your search of and lowering your threshold of what you may allow to be a relevant sample or positive sample. So therefore, your precision is reduced, whereas maximizing precision tends to reduce recall. So maybe your threshold of what you define as being relevant is rather higher. So maybe of the documents you identify, you have more precision in that set of documents you identify as relevant, but you miss a large number of the relevant documents, right? And then also, this is a good measure to be aware of. You'll see it quite often. So this is the F1 score, which is sort of a composition between precision and recall. So you're using these precision and recall values to essentially calculate this new value, which is not as interpretable, but it's a good summary of the composition of precision and recall. So, for instance, maybe you have 90% precision but 70% recall, and you may have a F1 score of roughly somewhere around 80%. Yeah? Any questions on precision, recall, or F1 score for the moment? No? If not, we're going to look at some other, at least binary evaluation metrics. And I mentioned these mostly for completeness. These are kind of filling out some of the other common measures that you see, such as the true negative rate. This is the amount of true negatives identified over the possible number of negative samples. The false positive rate, which is the percentage of negative samples that were incorrectly classified as positive, represented here, and the false negative rate, which is the percentage of positive samples that were incorrectly classified as negative. So this is the number of false negatives over the positives, right? And often when I quickly talk over these things, I get a bit confused of the double negatives and whatnot, so at least for me, this is common. But kind of one of the reasons also why I mention these measures is to introduce the receiver operating characteristic curve. So we've seen this, at least in the past lecture, right? Does anybody want to take a shot at kind of what it means, this graph here? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was saying it's essentially a graph showing the relationship between the true positives, true positive rates, and the false positive rates. And you would like to remain on the left side of the graph, as this indicates that you have a low false positive rate. And I would say, more or less, that's very much what it is. Is there any other items that anybody wants to mention regarding this graph? Like, for instance, how is it that we get all of these different measures or comparisons between true positive rates and false positive rates? So if you, you know, assess a model at, say, single, given some single set of parameters, you're only going to get, say, one comparison between the true positive rate and false positive rate, right? So, like, how we get all of, like, this curve here is that usually for these kinds of classifiers, there's some sort of threshold which that we can adjust, which, say, dictates whether something is positive or negative. And by adjusting this threshold, we can kind of draw this entire line. And I'm going to show you, jump ahead for the moment. So like here we have some Gaussian distribution of positive samples and negative samples, where we have this line that we're adjusting, where we can say, okay, if we have the threshold here, this calculates the true positive rate versus the false positive rate. And this is why we have this curve, right? So ideally, what you would want is you'd want your model to perform at this point right here in the top left corner, that being you have very high true positive rates. So the items that you're identifying as positive are actually positive. And you have a low false positive rate, so you're not identifying any negatives as positive. And basically, you don't want to be anywhere along this line because, like, for instance, if you are on the line here, or at this point in the very bottom left, this kind of indicates that you are describing everything as, I believe, negative. So if you classify as everything as negative, you'll have no false positive rate, but you have no false positive rate, but you will also not have any, you'll also have a zero true positive rate. And on the other hand, in the top right corner, this would be indicating you're disclassifying everything as positive. So here, you have a high true positive rate. You're naming all the positive things as positive, but where'd my mask go? But you're also naming all the negative things as positive as well. That's having a very high false positive rate, right? So, right, ideally, your model kind of performs in the top left corner, and we can get an overall idea of the quality of this this model by taking the area underneath this curve. I would say that in general, at least in my experience, ROC curves are more commonly found in things like biometrics as opposed to information security or digital forensics. In particular, they will map the relationship between the false match rate and the false non-match rate, which more or less is false match rate being that would be the errors in which a person is, say, classified as another person, and the false non-match rate being the case where a person's thumbprint should match what's in the register, but it does not, right? So you can imagine these curves being, say, positive and negative matches for, I don't know, fingerprint or iris, something like this. Measures for multi-class classification. So, again, generally speaking, the most popular metric for this is the classification accuracy, which is a percentage of properly classified samples. And does anybody want to mention why kind of a weakness for classification accuracy for multi-class classification? Yes.
You do have a lot of classes, and it depends on how your data set is kind of distributed, but a really good classification accuracy doesn't necessarily mean that you're as good at classifying every type of class. It's more like, okay, in the total data set, I did hit this well, but if you look at specific classes like the, I don't know, the CD one or the CB one, it's only hit one.
Yeah, so that's correct. So what he was more or less saying is that, yes, the classification accuracy does tell you overall how many classes were matching, how many predicted classes are matching their actual classes, but that does not hold over the specific classes over the data set. So, for instance, you may have maybe a 90% accuracy, but class C individually, they had a poor performance with respect to classifying items of class C well, for instance. Another way that is commonly represented for multi-class classification is the use of these confusion matrices. And what you'll see sometimes when you're programming is not only will they have these counts, so I mean, here, this is just like the binary classification case, but rather than just positive samples and negative samples, we just have, say, some n number of classes where you're saying, okay, for class, in the easy case, class A, we predicted all of the samples of class A correctly. So there are 10 samples of class A, and all of them were predicted correctly, whereas opposed to class C, there are 10 samples that are actually of class C, but we incorrectly predicted some class C samples as, say, class D here, two here being misclassified as class D, one being misclassified as class B, one being misclassified as class A, right? And in programming and then some like actual visualizations of these confusion matrices, sometimes this will be kind of represented like as a heat map. So this box might be, say, very green, and this box might be very red, just to visualize it. There are some less popular measures for multi-class classification. For instance, they're found in the book, and they're still used in the literature, but I would say maybe more in the medical realm than, say, information security, at least from what I have seen. So, for instance, there's something like called the misclassification cost. So, again, this think about it in the medical realm. Sometimes the misclassification from one class to another is way more significant than vice versa. So, say, you don't want to misclassify something that is, you know, misclassifying something maybe is not that is not cancerous as cancerous is maybe less bad than misclassifying something that is cancerous than not cancerous, because then you're missing the cancer, for instance. And then you take this average weight of the weighted misclassification costs. And then there's something called the Breyer score as well, which is another kind of cost function. And this is something I haven't really seen much in the research, at least in information security. But again, I think it appears in the medical realm. Basically, it's like a multinomial version of the mean squared error, where basically if you misclassify something as something of another class, you give it a error of 1, and you do this for, say, all the samples, and you take the average. That is more or less the Breyer score in the nutshell. But I think for you guys, really the most things that you need to focus on is classification accuracy and confusion matrix. Any more questions with regards to kind of these classification measures? It's all decently clear. Yeah? Okay, let's talk about splitting up our data set. So if we don't have an explicit training and testing data set, what is a good ratio for splitting the training and testing data sets? Have you seen what that, I don't want to say a magical number is, but that common number that people use? Yes. 80-20 is a very common one. So 80% of the data that you have being used for training, 20% of the data that you have used for testing. Why do we split the data set in general? Kind of what's the purpose of holding out this test data?
To see the accuracy.
To see the accuracy, but kind of thinking more motivationally, why do we do it? Yeah, we don't want to be using data that is already seen by the model that we've used to train the model and then test on it. So the purpose, more or less, is that this is an attempt to see how well the model generalizes to, say, samples that is not yet seen. I'm going to go over this a bit more, but I'm going to go over this a bit more. Then later we're going to talk about cross-validation. Here are some other kind of points that you should remember with regards to data. So ideally, for having training data and testing data, you should have some sufficiently large amount of data, right? So you should have enough training data to learn the general nature of the data, ideally speaking, and you should have enough testing data to accurately verify the model. Trying to see how well it generalizes on data is not yet seen. And that kind of magic number that you commonly see, but is no hard and fast rule, this is just kind of a rule of thumb, is an 80-20 split. So sometimes you see things like, 30-70, 90-10, or vice versa, I should say. But quite commonly, 80-20. Cross-validation. What is cross-validation? And in particular, what is K-fold cross-validation? So, does anybody remember what K-fold cross-validation is? It's, generally speaking, a way to split up your data set into, say, multiple data sets to run multiple tests. I'll get into it more specifically. But in general, cross-validation, it's a method for evaluation metric validation for some supervised model. So the main point is you're trying to find a general result that is ideally not data set specific, or in particular, it's not specific on how you split your data set. So sometimes you might get really, really lucky or really, really unlucky with how you've split your data set. So for some training and testing data split, maybe you get, 95% accuracy or something like this. But this might have been kind of a one-off thing. You might have had, say, easy samples for the training and testing, or maybe you may get really, really unlucky where based on the splits you get, say, 70% accuracy. So this can happen. It's also quite useful when working with smaller data sets or only have a training data set. But the general idea, kind of like what I was saying before, is you split a given data set into learners. So essentially, individual training and testing splits applied to your model, trained on distinct subsets of data, and then test the learners on the subsets of data that was left out. So this is super common to apply. K-fold cross-validation is like, you should know it. So this is it in general. So in the other lecture, you heard a number of different kinds of cross-validation, but the general type is K-fold cross-validation. There's something called twofold, and leave one out cross-validation, but these are subsets of K-fold cross-validation. And essentially, this is how it works. Yeah. So you want to be training, I shouldn't say create, but you want to be training K-models where you're kind of splitting up the data sets in the following way. And then you'll average the performance on the K-test data sets. So, for instance, in the first fold, say, for example, for four-fold cross-validation, you can think about it as you can fold your data into fourths, where the first fourth of your data, you are leaving that out as test data, and the remaining amount of your data is training data. And you take your model, and you train it on this training data, and you test it on this testing data, and you get the results, the accuracy, the precision, the recall, whatever. And then for the next fold, you then hold out this subset of the data, and you train on the remainder of the data, the remaining three-fourths of the data. And again, you train the model and test it, you get the accuracy, precision, et cetera, so forth. And you do this for K iterations, right? And then you're going to want to take the average, say, accuracy, precision, or recall, or whatever you're measuring. And it's a good idea to also record, say, what the standard deviation or variance of the result is as well, because this tells you how much the results are changing between the different tests. Yeah? So do we have a good understanding, more or less, of what K-fold cross-validation is? It's not a metric, but it is a method to verify your results. Then there's another kind of K-fold cross-validation called stratified cross-validation. This is where you enforce the original distribution of the classes across each fold. So say in your data set you have, 60% of your samples are class green and 40% of the samples are class red. So in this case, you would say you'd force the training data set to have 40% red, 60% green, and likewise in the testing data set as well. You might have remembered in the past tutorial when I was running these examples using Google Colab that I shuffled the data before I split the data set. Maybe you can see why that's useful when we're applying something like K-fold cross-validation. So for instance, if our training data, which I just obtained from a CSV file, is just some list of, say, here are 50 samples of class A and here are 50 samples of class B, then if you just applied K-fold cross-validation straight on that data, then you're going to get some really bad results. Because for instance, that would mean in that case, you would have a test data set of only class A, and then a training data set that's pretty badly imbalanced, right? So that's why we did this kind of randomization, the shuffling, which is kind of like a sampled, randomized version of stratified cross-validation. Any last questions regarding cross-validation, K-fold cross-validation? You'll see this a ton. Do you guys need a break? It's been 45 minutes. We can give a 10-minute break, and then we can just be back here at 10:10. So see you in 10 minutes. Yeah? All right, let's go ahead and continue. What does it mean for a model to be overfitted or underfitted?
There's too much data.
There's too much data. I would say that in some ways, too much data could contribute to overfitting, but I would say that it's typically not the reason. Yes?
Trying to follow patterns that don't exist.
In which case, for underfitting or overfitting? For overfitting. So I would say that the patterns do exist, but they exist maybe on the training data set and not necessarily in general for that type of data. Yes?
Is it concerning the relationship between the classification accuracy for learning and the classification accuracy for testing? Do you have a really hard testing accuracy but a low learning accuracy and vice versa?
I would say this is a related concept. So he was saying if overfitting or underfitting is related to the classification accuracy of, say, verifying the accuracy on the training data versus on the testing data. And overfitting or underfitting definitely does influence these two factors. But we can get right into it. So, essentially, and this is kind of what you were saying, for underfitting, and I've shown examples for both regression and for classification here, underfitting indicates that you have a high training error. So as you can see here, you have some, say, linear regression model that does not fit some obviously nonlinear data quite well. And then in the case for classification, you can see that you just have some linear classifier, which has a large number of errors. The circles should be on the left, and X's should be on the right. One thing, though, for underfitting, kind of a symptom of it, is that the training error should be kind of somewhat close to the testing error. So this is kind of indicated by this line here. Still, both of them being high, that the model kind of still performs generally okay, but even worse than in the training case. So this is the idea for underfitting with respect to regression and classification. The main idea being that you are quite literally the model is underfits on the training data. Yeah? As opposed to overfitting, where you have a low training data error. So this here is the regression example, where say you have some regression line which tries to capture, say, all of or predict all of your training data samples correctly. And you may get, say, for your classification boundary, some pretty wacky borders. So for instance, like if you had a really high amount of overfitting and you had a, say, the classifier try to say, okay, the circle over here, you know, that should be always class, maybe this boundary would go all the way over here, which may not apply well generally to unseen training data. So the idea about being that the training error is much, much lower than the testing error. However, the problem is that on unseen data, that this amount of overfitting actually works adversely. So say for regression or classification, when you try to calculate that testing error, it's actually going to be quite high. Yeah? So here's kind of an example, and here loss, you can just interpret it as, say, error, and training epochs, just interpret it as the number of
say, iterations that the model is being trained on the data. So, say, the more iterations of training, the training error gets lower and lower. It gets more and more tuned to the actual training data. But, say, for the testing data, the held-out data, the general data, this boundary, which is being overfit to your training data, is really making the testing evaluation much, much worse. Yeah? So, do we get the idea of underfitting a model versus overfitting a model? We can see here this is underfitting with respect to regression and underfitting and overfitting with regression, underfitting with classification, overfitting with classification. Ideally, we want our model to be somewhere in between. Yeah? You want it to kind of fit on the training data, but maybe not too much. So these two ideas of underfitting and overfitting are related to the concepts of these error concepts for models called bias and variance. Do we know what bias or variance are? These are essentially, say, conditions of your models, and they produce these kinds of errors with respect to overfitting or underfitting. So bias, essentially, it is the simplicity of the learning algorithm may have the inability to capture nuanced relationships in training data. So, for instance, models with high bias are going to be like these linear models. So linear regression, this has high bias. Essentially, there are limitations to what it can model based on its simplicity. Likewise, linear classifiers also have a high amount of bias. So these concepts of these models with high bias is related to underfitting on the training data. So models with high bias, they have significant errors between the predictions and training data, and then likewise, but similar but likely worse results for errors on the testing data set. And the introduction of a new sample to the training data would not change the model much. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't say it zones in on a particular part of the data set. Is that it is unable to capture complex relationships, usually because the model is very simple. So this, it's kind of like there are, say, limitations on the model and how much it can capture the relationships of the data set, say, between the features or whatnot. But with respect to this idea of introducing a new sample in the training, that would not change the model much. So, for example, a model with high bias, if you added like a single point right here, the linear regression model would not move that much. Maybe it'd move a little from here to here. Not much affected by a lot of changes in the training data. Likewise, if we had a circle added to this data set, say, over here, rather than having a linear classifier like this, might shift just a little bit. So, as you can see, high bias is kind of related, is quite related to underfitting. I would say that underfitting is a symptom of models with high bias. So examples of this being applying linear regression on complex nonlinear data. Then there is a opposing sort of error, called variance, in which machine learning models can capture these nuanced relationships in data, but they can be overly influenced by the training data, thus causing poor generalization. So training on different data sets will end up resulting in quite different final models, and high variance is related to this concept of overfitting. In the case that we added, say, an additional data point to a high-variance model, it would change the model quite a lot. So here, let's say we added, where'd my mouse go? A data point right here for the regression model. We might get this gigantic spike appearing here. Yeah? Or likewise, if we have an extremely high variance model for classification, and we added a circle over here, this boundary may now have this crazy octopus arm string looping the classification boundary saying, this deserves to be on the circle side. Yeah? So something like the mean squared error of a high variance regression model, you will have a high, mean squared error of high variance regression model for training set may be zero. So this concept of overfitting, but for the test set, it may be high. So overfitting is a symptom of models with high variance. And there's a trade-off when trying to attempt to minimize both types of errors, this bias variance trade-off. So, for example, models with high variance can be deep neural networks, especially if you train them for too long, and they overfit quite a lot on your training data, but then they do not exactly generalize well to unseen data. So typically speaking, models that can be very complex will have high variance, and models that are very simple have high bias. Any questions with respect to overfitting, underfitting, bias, and variance? You're okay? Okay, on to another sort of idea. Has anybody here heard of ensemble learning? No? It's another kind of meta learning method. Basically, the idea is that you combine the outputs of multiple classifiers to contribute to a supervised task in making some sort of decision. So here you have, say, multiple models, for example, trained on different aspects of a data set, and then when it comes to the testing data, you apply the testing samples to each model, and they each essentially like get a vote, and then you combine the results of their votes and do some sort of final decision, right? This can be applied to both regression or classification. So there's two, say, very popular methods, the first of which is called bagging. And I would say that, in general, this is more popular than the next method I'm going to mention. Bagging is short for bootstrap aggregation, and more or less this is how it works. So you create multiple subsets of the training data sets by sampling with replacement from the data. So say you have some training data here, and then what you do is essentially say, I want n different learners, and so you sample this data n different times, where you're creating these subsets of the data, and then you train each of your classifiers with a subset of the data that you've chosen. Yeah? And typically speaking, they will choose classifiers that are very simple, that have high bias. And then, basically, once you have these trained models, they each, say you produce some test sample to it, you say, okay, each of the models make a prediction on what the result of the sample is, what class does this sample go to, they all take a vote, and then essentially, typically speaking, it's not a requirement, but there's a majority voting rule that chooses the final answer for the classification. Yeah? So why do this in the first place? Well, the combination of weak learners is shown to be better than, say, a single weak learner. So you'll see this commonly being applied to something like decision trees. Also, one nice thing is that it is a method to get some pretty good results that also limits overfitting, where it's less prone to this variance error. So essentially, I think inherently, by using machine learning models with high bias and, say, low variance, the combination of the results is what is resulting in the low variance solution overall.
leading to this less overfitting. The other kind of benefit is that weak learners can be trained very, very quickly. So, for instance, potentially you may get some very good results using bagging that is maybe comparable to some other state-of-the-art solutions, but you can train it very, very fast. Yeah? So this is one example of ensemble learning, this bagging approach. Then there is boosting. So bagging, the learning was done in parallel. You had these parallel learners and these parallel data sets. And boosting is kind of the opposite. Rather than learning in parallel, you're actually learning in sequence. So I'm going to show you the visualization of this beforehand because it's kind of easier to understand. So basically, you're taking your training data set and you train the classifier on that data set, and then you actually evaluate with testing with samples from the training data set. And what you do is, based on the results that you get, you take the samples that were misclassified and you use that as a way to, say, weight your training data set, making these misclassified samples more important in your data set than, say, the samples that were correctly classified. And then you again train your classifier, but now with your weighted data set. And if your data set, if the samples cannot be directly weighted, you may substitute this with just, say, the more important samples are probabilistically chosen more often than samples that were correctly classified. And basically, you run this over and over again through n different times until you have some, say, highly weighted data sets which you are running through your classifier and have your, say, ultimate classifier at the end. So, why do boosting? Again, this is actually, they consider applying this to machine learning models which are, say, weak learners, models with high bias. In general, it reduces bias, this kind of sequential learning on this type of model. And the results for this ensemble learning method performs much, much better than a single weak learner. So again, this is actually applied to something like decision trees. And another reason to use it is that these weak learners can be trained very, very quickly. So you can have many, many sequences of learning for this boosting method. So this is another type of ensemble learning, kind of this in-sequence learning where you're weighing the data set based on misclassification errors on the training data set. So it actually kind of increases the amount of overfitting that the model does, but I think also because the model inherently is a high bias but low variance type of model, it shouldn't ideally result in too much overfitting. Yeah? Yes?
The book discusses a type of learning where you update your hypothesis as you go, kind of in the same way this does, but more focused on the model or hypothesis and not the data. Is that different from boosting? Because that takes in some data and then creates an hypothesis and then uses that hypothesis to keep learning and making new hypotheses?
Yeah, it might be a little different. Do you know how it refers to it?
I don't remember what it's called.
Okay, because I think, as at least with respect to boosting, it's quite commonly kind of focusing on the data set here. I'd have to see the example from the book. But there are tons of different types of ensemble learning methods, so these are not like the only two. These are two popular examples. Any other questions with respect to overfitting, underfitting, bagging and boosting, variance bias? Okay.
Present your understanding of the minimum description length principle. Do we know what that is? I know you have an idea of what it is. Does anybody else kind of know how to describe it? I would say that this is a mostly theoretical kind of guiding principle for the model selection problem. Basically, which model are you going to choose that's, say, best for your scenario? But in a nutshell, I think the best way to describe it is select the model and the parameters for that model, which best losslessly compresses your data. So the idea is that if we find patterns in the data that we can learn, kind of much like compression, if you find patterns in the data, you can compress the data. So we're viewing learning as a kind of this information theoretic compression. So I was mentioning in tutorial one, ideally that you can, if you had the perfect model that learned, say, perfectly from your training data set, you can ideally throw away all of your training and testing data and only have the model. And so say, okay, input some sample with these features into your model, and it would always output, say, the correct prediction for that sample, say the correct class or whatnot. And this is kind of how we are viewing this kind of compression. So there's also some other factors to take into account when like selecting the model and how you are assessing what is the best amount of, say, compression a model does on the data. So for instance, ideally the model is small, say in terms of actual storage on your computer, in terms of its runtime for training and testing, size of the number of parameters and its attributes. However, I would say that history shows that the first quality, that being kind of model accuracy, how well your model performs on, say, predictions, is most favored in terms of, like, compressing the actual training data. So, like, for example, state-of-the-art deep learning models have models with millions and millions of parameters and are, say, 1 gigabyte in size. And so in a pure information theoretic kind of approach, this is quite a large model that compresses your data. But in terms of performance, it does the lossless compression of your data, training data, very, very well. So another kind of associated idea with the minimum description length principle is treat model selection in terms of Occam's razor. So the simplest explanation is the most reliable. So this is kind of the idea of the minimum description length principle in a nutshell. Very much, I would say, focus on the idea that you want to choose models that can compress your data quite well. Imagine you can just throw away all of your training and testing data and only rely on the model to produce the actual predictions or labels of your samples. Yes. Any questions with respect to the MDL? It's a bit of a theoretical idea. Okay. Last kind of theoretical question of the day is, what is a objective function? What is a cost function? So this was actually introduced in the last lecture. Does anybody know what this is? Maybe you've heard of it in terms of another way to refer to it, like the loss function or the error function, something like this. Okay, so if you recall in the last lecture, there were some discussions of a function that you wish to optimize, yeah? So this is that function. Basically what this is, it's a function that indicates how well a model fits its training data. So this is often measuring, say, the difference between the actual target values from your training data set compared to your actual predictions that you're making. So the actual, and then you're essentially getting the error from the difference between the target values and your predicted values. Yeah? So kind of like in terms of motivation, as opposed to evaluation measures, which are just trying to say, okay, how well your model performs generally, the purpose of this function is actually to guide the training of your model, at least for many, many machine learning models and algorithms. So it's a function whose optimization during training will lead to the best fit of a model, at least on your training data. So the iteration of a model's learning is often trying to minimize, say, the error of this function, or maximize, say, the fitness of this function. It depends on what your objective function is, how it's defined for that particular machine learning algorithm. So in order to optimize this function, it utilizes some sort of optimization method, which we will get into in lecture and tutorial 3. So unfortunately, to see a lot of the details of it, we're going to have to wait until, say, next week or the week afterwards. So I'm trying to show you what this is kind of by an example. So the mean squared error can be a measure of evaluation for a regression function, but it also can be an objective function for regression. So we can define some learning task that we have as an optimization problem, where we're attempting to minimize the following function, where we're searching for the best weights. So in this example, say that I should have put the full, yeah. Say that we have some linear regression, and we have some function here defined in the following way with these weights, weight 0 and weight 1. So we can define the problem of trying to fit this function onto our data is trying to minimize this function, the mean squared error. And what's actually kind of nice is that we can define this function, this mean squared error function, in terms of the weights, right? So basically, this is saying, okay, what is the error between the target values of the data and the predicted values for these points with respect to the weights that we currently have. So there's a lot of different ways to go about optimization, which we're going to go over in, say, 1 or 2 weeks, that optimize this value EW. But kind of the main crux of the idea, I think, is that over the iterations of your training, which is how a lot of models actually learn, you use the output error, VW, as feedback in order to update the weights, W, for your model. So, for instance, maybe you start off with your linear regression model like so, just Y equals X. So you have for weight 0, that equals, weight 0, you have it equal to 0. Weight 1, you have it equal to 1. And you calculate the mean squared error, which is quite large. You go over some iterations of optimization, where the error is used to update the weights. And then you might, say, draw a new line. For instance, right here, I can draw it. For instance, you can draw it right here. And then, say, the errors are going to be less. And these errors then contribute again to updating the weights until ideally we get to the choice of weights such that this function outputs something as small as possible. Yeah? So here are some kind of final thoughts to take away with respect to the objective function. The optimization of this function guides the model's parameters in their training, at least for many different models. A common objective function is the sum of squares. So it's kind of interesting because we've seen the mean squared error being applied to regression, but you will actually find this kind of cost function or objective function in many applications that are not, say, strictly regression. So, for example, you will find this kind of function in things like support vector machines, deep neural networks, and many other algorithms, not just applied to regression, but also to, say, classifying problems. And then also unsupervised tasks can also be defined in this way to set up as an optimization problem. So kind of the big takeaways is that machine learning algorithms, they can be set up as these optimization problems where you have some objective function in combination with the training data where you are trying to minimize or maximize this objective function to fit your model as best as possible on the training data. So it's still a bit maybe of a theoretical kind of confusing idea right now, but in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to actually show some examples of how to fit like a regression model onto some data as well as a classifying model where we show how when we optimize this function, we get a tight fit of the model on the data. So this is just kind of a preface to this idea, I suppose. Any other questions with respect to the objective function? We'll learn about it more later. I only wanted to bring it up because it was already brought up in the lecture. Any last questions regarding some of these more theoretical ideas before we get into some more of the practical things? No? Okay. We have some practical tasks here, and I don't know if I want to explicitly go over them in class because they're fairly simple. Essentially, what we have here is we have a confusion matrix, and the idea is that you can verify yourselves what the evaluation metrics you can calculate are. So, for instance, we're asking you, based on these values here, calculate things like accuracy, sensitivity, specificity, recall, and precision. Yeah. I don't think I'm going to go over everything here, but just for an example here, calculating the accuracy is as simple as going to the confusion matrix and saying, okay, we have 18 true positives plus 16 true negatives. This is 34 over the total number of samples. It's 85%, right? So I think you guys can plug in these values here and verify for this for yourselves. I don't think it's worth going over explicitly. So I have all the equations written out here so you can verify. With respect to regression, let's see here. So we're asking you to, we have some expected predicted value from some model that we have and the observed value, and we're just asking you to calculate the mean squared error, root mean squared error, and mean absolute error. Again, I think this is kind of straightforward. You're going to be plugging in values here and calculating them. Before I had asked to actually calculate the Pearson correlation coefficient, but I don't care about that, so just feel free to skip that if you're doing this at home. So here is like the plot of the data, and motivationally speaking, the errors are going to be the distances between the observed value and the expected value, right? So this is kind of how to motivate the idea. The mean squared is just, or the squared error is just taking the square of the error. So very simple. Just taking the difference between the observed and the expected value, square it, add it, take the mean. Yeah? Simple enough. And you can verify for yourselves the answers for these solutions. I think what I want to do is just jump to the Google Colab. So for those following along, feel free to join in this. Oh.
Sorry, Janice, I had missed a question that you had about K-fold cross-validation. Janice asks, is there an upper bound to K where higher K does not any longer give additional insider value? I would say so. I don't think there's a hard rule about what that value is for K. I think, practically speaking, you just wouldn't want to have a training or testing data set that's, well, I don't think, because you can, I don't think there is an upper bound you can choose. I think the greatest upper bound that you can have is, let's see here, let's go back to the slides. There is, I think the upper bound that you would have would be twofold cross-validation, where you're using half of the data set for training and half of it for testing, because you can also do this leave one out K-fold cross-validation, where essentially you just have one sample for testing and everything else for training. Practically speaking, I don't know how often that comes into play. I've not seen any research that's done leave one out K-fold cross-validation. Typically speaking, though, I think the rule of thumb usually says like 10-fold cross-validation or 5-fold cross-validation. These are common numbers. Okay. Let's jump into this kind of programming example. So for this example, what we have here is kind of a combination of sources I've drawn from. But more or less, what we're trying to do is we're trying to do some spam classification. So what you're going to make sure you have is you want to make sure that you've downloaded this spam CSV file from the appropriate link that I have mentioned here, and then just drop it in kind of your local folder on the left side. And we are going to try to build a classifier that automates the classification of spam text messages versus ham text messages, which are just, say, the inoffensive text messages. So what we're going to do is just read in our data, again using pandas, which is kind of just like an interactive way to manage this tabular kind of CSV style data. And here, just as a note, I had to do a special encoding to correctly read in this spam data because there's some unusual characters, I believe. So be aware of that when you are reading in your data. But here is some selection of some of the messages in the data set. So here is, you see things like ham, just, I don't know, some people talking about this or that. Then spam, see free entry into two, a weekly competition to win blah, blah, cup finals, blah, blah, blah. Right? So let's see the distribution of our spam versus ham messages, because this can be pretty insightful with respect to imbalanced data, especially for training and for testing. So luckily for us, we can do a pretty quick count using this pandas data frame on the number of ham messages versus spam. So we see that we have nearly 5,000 ham messages and nearly 750 spam messages. So this data set is pretty imbalanced, I would say. Yeah? Okay, so let's do some basic kind of visualization and exploration of the data. And a good way to do that, at least with something like texts, is we can make some word clouds. And it's also a fun way to visualize the data as well. So I'm not going to go too much into the details of what this kind of pre-processing is doing, but essentially it's taking the data
and lowercasing the text, and then it's splitting the words, say, based on the spaces, because right now we have strings beforehand, and we have to turn it into, say, like a list of strings. And then we're just adding these individual words into, say, just a large string or a large list. So the spam word cloud looks like follows, right? So we can see that some of the most represented words here, and I believe the whole idea is that the size of the word is indicative of how often the words appears in the actual data set. So for spam messages, you see words like free, call, text, now, urgent, so on and so forth, right? And then a word cloud for the ham data set. Looks like so. Sees things like second time, one contact, tried, et cetera, et cetera. for a ham data set, I'm still somewhat surprised that you see things like, you know, one, prize, claim, national rate. So it could be indicative of the quality of this data set. It doesn't look like there's maybe too much separation between the two. But this is the data set we have, so we're going to work with it. So let's try to make a classifier that separates these ham messages from these spam messages. So at least with respect to kind of traditional natural language processing, we need to do some initial pre-processing on the texts. And we're only going to do a couple of things. So recall, a lot of the times for machine learning algorithms, we need to start from some actual data and turn it into some like numerical features. And this is kind of the steps that we're going about trying to do that. And in particular, right now, what we're trying to do is avoid redundant features. So to avoid redundant features, first of what we're going to do is we're going to say reduce the text to lowercase, and then we're also trying to remove what are known as stop words from the text. So stop words are essentially like these little articles that quite commonly appear in language, such as like the, he, a, it, words that appear often but don't have that much like say semantic meaning or influence in the text. So this is what this preprocessing is doing here. So if you take a look here, you can see it's missing a lot of like the I's and the says. So this message here is like, nah, don't think, goes, USF, lives, around, though. And we didn't remove all of the possible stop words. There's probably more words that we can remove, but we're just starting with the standard list of stop words to remove. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take our data sets. And say at this moment we've sufficiently pre-processed the data. We're not going to go into deep into the pre-processing of trying to make the best possible pre-processed text data set as possible. But what we are going to do is we're going to split the data set into a trained set and a test set, right? And we're using an 80-20 split, and I've set the random states to a static value, so if you run this test, you should get the same split as me. So I've split it into a training and testing data set. And looking at the training data set, of course, we have quite an imbalanced data set here between ham and spam, and likewise, quite an imbalanced data set between ham and spam for the testing data set. So typically speaking, when you train a classifier on an imbalanced data set, the classifier has a really strong bias towards the dominant class. This is usually the common instance, and it makes sense to why that would be. It's you're over-influencing the training with say, in this case, the negative samples, the ham samples. So we're doing a little bit more pre-processing just to make sure that our code works. I'm going to skip over that for the moment. And now at this point, we're going to convert our data from text into actual numerical vectors. So recall in the first tutorial, I was showing you this bag of words approach, right? Where essentially for each document, you have a vector which has the count of the occurrence of words in that, say, sentence or that document. And that's what we're doing here, yeah? So we're using something from sklearn called count vectorizer. So we are transforming, and what you want to be aware of is that we are transforming and fitting with respect to the training data. So essentially we have a vocabulary that's built from the training data, and then we are turning the testing vector or test data sets into vectors based on the vocabulary from the training data as well. So basically, the whole point here is that the test data set cannot introduce any new words into these vectors, right? So that is why we're doing that here. And this is just an example here. So we have some document sample here saying, I can't recall if this is ham or spam, but it looks like it's spam to me. But essentially, this is the kind of the bag of words approach, vectorization of this document above. And so here you can say, okay, there's one representation of the 2,551st word. There's one representation of the 6,453rd word, so on and so forth. And just as kind of a little bit of a caveat, I think this count vectorizer does some additional pre-processing on the text. So I've noticed there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the actual text here and what is and the number of items in the vectors here. Yes. Yeah, so, sorry, I think I went over that a little fast. So fit transform here for train X. So the idea is that with the training data set, we're going to make the length of the vectors based on the dictionary of words that we have. And we want this dictionary to be with respect to the training data. The reason why that is because when we look at the testing data, there's the possibility that we have words that do not exist in the training data. And then essentially we're going to get a different sized vector than in the training data. So essentially for the testing data, we want to fit our testing data onto, say, the features of the training data. So otherwise the vectors may be of different length or may represent different words. So that's why we're only fitting the testing data onto this bag of words, as opposed to this fit transform for the training data. Yeah? Okay, so now we have converted, say, all of our data from, we've pre-processed our text, and we've converted the text into numerical vectors, and now we're ready to actually, say, apply this to some machine learning algorithm for training and testing, right? And we're using a very simple machine learning algorithm. We're using naive Bayes. And because we're using Python, it's as simple as kind of just calling in the library and saying train and test. So here we have trained the model, and we have tested the model with respect to our testing data. And we actually have surprisingly high accuracy, given that we are working with an imbalanced training and testing data set. And I think I have some reasons why that is a little bit later. But kind of interesting things to look at. The precision and recall for ham is very, very high. For spam, we have pretty, very high precision, but we only have 88% recall. So we missed, say, 1/10 of the spam messages using this classifier. Yeah? Okay. So I said, okay, this is a bit surprising that the precision and recall for identifying spam is quite high. The assumption is that the model might just, because we're working with such an imbalanced data set, the model might just say, okay, just assume everything is ham. This is quite often what happens when you train a model with imbalanced data. It just chooses the majority class. So it is possible that the spam messages have some very telling features. So I went ahead and said, okay, let's test and see on these following messages how well the classifier guesses on the following messages. Yeah. So I wrote this message here. Dear Henry, I'm happy that this message has found you. Please respond at your convenience. And the classifier said, this is ham. Yeah. Then I wrote in the following message. It said, buy now sex XXX pills for no $$. The classifier said, oh, this is ham, which actually kind of makes more sense given our imbalanced data set. And I said, okay, well, what were some of our most popular words for the spam data set? It was free and call. I said, okay, let's say buy now six XXX pills for no $$$. Call free at this number. And then finally it said, oh, it's spam. So I think I said, okay, maybe this model is actually very easy to, say, linearly classify just based on the inclusion of these particular words, like call now. So I said, okay, looks like our data set is maybe quite easily linearly separable, even though it's a really high-dimensional space. And I should mention, too, the classification of short messages is not an easy task. Essentially, one way you can think about it is that your dictionary, the amount of words that you have in all these messages is going to be like, I don't know, say like a million features long, very, very long vectors, but these vectors are very, very sparse because these messages are very short. So if you only have 10 words, then you only have a vector with like a count of words in 10 different locations in the entire, say, I don't know, 10,000, 100,000 length vector. So anyways, I made this linear classifier. This time I'm using SVM, using the linear version of it, which essentially just makes this linear line that cuts through your data, say even in high-dimensional space. And I calculated the results, and we got 97.1% accuracy. 100% precision for spam, lower recall, though. I said, okay, so it looks like it's decently linearly splittable. Kind of verified on that front. I also kind of wanted to play around with seeing if we can get better, say, recall if we had a balanced training data set. So one possible way to address the issue of imbalanced data sets is with respect to sampling that data set in a certain way to produce an equal amount of positive and negative samples. And one such way to do that is to undersample in the dominant class. And so this is exactly what I did. So I essentially just went through our samples in the training data set, and I said, okay, just basically, for the first 3,000 ham messages, just ignore them. So I essentially reduced the training data set to 860 ham messages and nearly 600 spam messages, which is much more balanced than our original training data set. Yeah? And then more or less, I did the same procedures before with respect to pre-processing the text, and then I was using naive Bayes to train a classifier model. And I said, okay, what kind of results are we going to get now? So here, I mean, the accuracy overall was slightly less. The precision for identifying spam messages was less, but actually the recall improved. So we identified more of the spam messages than we had for the previous kinds of tests, which is kind of interesting. So with regards to if recall is more important than precision, which sometimes it is, this could be a viable way to try to combat that with respect to this imbalanced data set. Maybe I went through that a little fast, but are there any questions with respect to this example? And you're free to play around with it as much as you want. So feel free there. But, I mean, otherwise, let me just check the chat. Otherwise, that's all I have for you today. So thank you for listening. And I should also mention, I uploaded homework 4. So if you want to do that, take a look. But yes, thanks, and we'll see you next week.